Hi, everyone. This is David Wood, and welcome back to Wood on Words, the podcast for all things writing and publishing. This is episode 35, in which I'm going to have a chat with thriller author Toby Neal. It was a fantastic interview. I think you're going to enjoy it and also get a lot out of it. But first, let's kind of catch up. A few things that are happening in the publishing world. One of them is that Kobo is going to begin selling audiobooks. And right now, the way it looks is that they are going to get content. They already have some content from certain publishers, and they're going to be drawing content from other providers. One is Findaway Books. That is one that comes to mind immediately for me because I just signed a deal with them. And they've got an interesting model going on where they're going to distribute to a lot of different places, and they're offering price control, for one thing, which is a great tool for indies, and they don't have exclusivity requirements. Now, obviously, if you use them to also distribute to the usual suspects, Audible, iTunes, and Amazon, they're going to take a cut. You'll get a little less than you would have. Or if you choose to go non-exclusive through, say, ACX, you'll get lower royalties there too. But anyway, I'm going to give them a try. I'm interested in seeing how some of these other markets develop and mature and whether price control can make any difference. The problem I have right now is that almost everything I have in my catalog is exclusive with ACX. I have only two completed audiobooks at the moment that are non-exclusive, so I'm going to start with those, probably add a few more going forward non-exclusive titles, and then in 2019, some of my catalog is, the contract will be up with ACX, and I'll just take a look and see if Findaway has been able to do anything for me. Now, in my case, I'm dealing directly with them. They reached out to me and signed me, but I believe you can also publish to Findaway through Draft Digital, so that's something to take a look at. But anyway, I like Kobo. I don't make a whole lot of money there compared to Amazon or even Nook or iBooks. I make okay money compared to Nook or iBooks, but not as much. But anyway, the thing I like about Kobo is they're very serious about doing a good job in every aspect. I think very highly of the people who run it, as opposed to somewhere like Nook that doesn't really seem to care anymore. So, curious to see what happens with Kobo Audio, how they manage to build their catalog, and see what happens with Findaway Books and some of these other providers. And I'm told that Findaway is actually in talks with iBooks about doing something direct with them, so you don't have to go through ACX for that channel, which would be very interesting. I don't know how close it is or if it's just something they hope to accomplish. But anyway, that's one thing that's in the news. Another is there's a big deal made about Amazon going after some authors and marketers who are abusing the KDP system. Now, there's way too much to talk about with this, so just Google it. Amazon goes after scammers, something like that. But it looks like they're going after people who have made fraudulent customer reviews, fake user accounts, and other people who are trying to scheme the system. Well, now, that's a great thing. It doesn't go nearly far enough. It's only a handful of people they're going after, but maybe it's the tip of the iceberg. At the moment, it doesn't look like they're going after any of these box set scammers who were abusing the system. We talked about one in particular who's now the subject of a lawsuit and has actually apparently moved her production off to another site so she doesn't have to, because she's been banned from KDP. But anyway, I'm hoping to see the box set scammers get what's coming to them. A lot of people abusing the system through that, fraudulently getting USA Today bestseller ranks, things like that. So anyway, interesting to see how Amazon moves on it and what they can do in the future. I also don't know what they're able to do in regards to some of these click farms that we've talked about that are located in other countries, but I hope that at minimum their system will get better at identifying books in Kindle Unlimited that are being click farmed and ban more accounts. We need to get rid of those people so they're not sucking up a portion of the money that should be divided among people who are playing by the rules and behaving ethically. So that's news with Amazon. One other, since we alluded to bestsellers, A couple of weeks ago, we talked about an author named Lanie Sarum, no idea if I'm pronouncing that correctly, Lanie Sarem, whose young adult book reached number one on the New York Times bestseller list because she or her representatives called around to bookstores, asked if they were New York Times reporting stores, and placed a bunch of orders. And we discussed the fact that if you time it correctly, you can place all these orders, the orders get reported to New York Times, you make the list, and then you call back and cancel them. And it doesn't even cost you any money to do that, just time. And we discussed the fact that there are some services you can hire who will do that for you. And in her case, the word got out, and New York Times took the unusual step of removing her from the list and reissuing the bestseller list with her off of it. And at the time, she denied doing anything wrong, claimed she didn't know what anybody was talking about. And then recently on Billboard, she wrote an article defending herself in which she admitted what she did. She still thinks it's fine. She tried to draw an analogy to artists who are selling CDs at their own concerts. She said that she was planning on touring around, and so to make sure that the stores had stock, she called and placed orders with the stores rather than taking the usual step of publishers, of going to your publisher saying, or publicist at your publisher, and saying, please make sure I have some stock. These are the places I'm going. Well, we could sit here and dissect her defense and, you know, talk about why it's baloney. But the short story is she scammed, she denied it, and now she's admitting it but trying to rationalize it away. And, you know, you could look up the article, but I don't think it's worth reading. It's just somebody who did something unethical and is now trying to talk her way out of it. So that's some of the high points in publishing news. In my own work, had another good week. I finished my pass over Exile, which is the next J.D. Hara adventure, and that is off with beta readers. And I am on the second draft of my super secret project. That's going very well. And still working a little bit each day, trying to do a 15-minute burst to warm up with my For the Love project. That's a book that I'm working on that I enjoy doing, but doesn't perform as well as some of my other lines. And so I just do it for fun. And it was interesting. I haven't done anything on that one today. And I was putting it off, and I realized, finally, as I was taking my morning walk, why I was resisting it. And that is that, unlike other books, I'm winging this one, pantsing it, which I have gotten away from over the years because it's just an inefficient way for me to work. In other cases, I outline. But this one I've just been winging, and I realize that I'm at the point where I'm at a decision point, and I don't know which way to go with the story. I have two ideas for the way it's going to be that won't really work together very well, and I don't have a plan. So that just goes to show that even with a commitment of a few minutes a day to crank out a few hundred words, you still need a plan. And I think that a lot of times, not just for me, but for a lot of people, the resistance to writing, the emotional or psychological resistance, the quote-unquote can't do it today, the so-called muse isn't visiting me today, comes from not knowing what to do next. When I have a thorough outline put together and I know exactly where the story is going, I find it much easier to sit down and get to work. And people complain about boredom, but first of all, even with an outline, you do have the freedom to change your plan if you want to. No one's stopping you. And also for me, the feeling of being productive, that's a great feeling. That gives me a boost. And, you know, screw boredom. I like getting the work done, and it's a great feeling to crank out the words, to make progress, and to know that you've had a good day of writing. So I am going to have to take some time from the Pleasure Project and go ahead and work on an outline, work on a plan, figure out what I'm going to do. It might not be as thorough as I do with some of my others, but I need to make some decisions about the plot because I've got the characters set up where they need to be, but now I've got to decide which way they're going to go. So that's what's happening in my writing. Also, I have mentioned previously that I'm going to be experimenting with audiobook bundles. I've done plenty of ebook bundles. But audiobook bundles are an interesting thing that's coming around with some authors. The idea is that on Audible in particular, readers typically, they pay for a membership and they have one credit a month that they can buy an audiobook of any length with. And an audiobook bundle is, in theory, more appealing to those readers because they get three or more books in one. I started my experiment back in mid-June with the Absent Gods trilogy, which I write under my David DeBoard pen name. I put the three books in the trilogy together and added a bonus story and re-released it. And typically, the three individual audiobooks from that trilogy each would sell 3 or 4 a month, maybe. I'd have to double-check my numbers, but it was very little. In the first month, it was really only about 3 weeks, we sold over 100. Sold over 100 again the next month. And I don't remember August, but I think it was very close to 100. We might have hit 100 again. And we're only at about 20 for this month so far. But it's still a lot better than it was doing before. So for me, the experiment has been worthwhile so far. Jeffrey Kafer, who narrates and produces the Dane Maddock books, and I have been working together to get bundles out of almost all of those books now. So we've got the first 6 Dane Maddock adventures out in bundles of 3, each with a bonus story, and then all 9 Dane Maddock Origins books are out in bundles of 3. Or excuse me, we've completed all of those. The only thing that's out so far is Dane Maddock Adventures Volume 1, and we've moved 20 in something like 4 days, so that's a good sign. I haven't promoted them other than, I think, 1 Facebook post and 1 tweet, but I'm going to look for opportunities to do that. So, yeah, very interested to see how the audiobook bundles develop. So, that is publishing industry news and my news. So, now let's move on to our interview with Toby Neal. We are here with author Toby Neal. Toby, welcome to What on Words.
Thank you. Thanks so much for reaching out and having me on your show.
It's my pleasure. For those of you who don't know, you are a thriller and police procedural author. You are a member, I have alluded to, a little group of which I'm a member of indie and hybrid authors who are doing pretty well. You're one of the ones who is really kicking ass, and I believe one of your series hit 1 million sales not too long ago.
Yeah, the Late Crime series. That is a 12-book mystery police procedural series. And, we hit the 1 million sales for the whole series, not any one book, about 2 years ago. So that's been really great. And then I've got several spinoffs, and I'm working most and that series is complete with 12 books. It started hitting the bestseller list at around book 10 when I, you know, people are curious, like, oh, you're an indie and you're hitting USA Today, you know, bestseller list. How are you doing that? And for me, it's a matter of building momentum as an indie. And it's no one book that carries the burden of that. It's very different from the mindset of traditional publishing where you're looking, you've got a lot of emphasis on an individual book breaking out. My experience is much more a series breaking out, and it does that by building momentum and fans.
Absolutely. Well, tell us a little about Lay Crime, and that's for people who aren't looking at the post online. It's L-E-I, Lay. Tell us a little about that.
Well, I'm from Hawaii, and basically, you know, that old saying, they say, write the book you want to read. I always wanted to read a fast-paced, semi-gritty, with a twist of romance, mystery set in Hawaii that didn't mess up the local culture. And Hawaii is very small but intricate place with many, many cultures living in it and getting along. And my family has been there, even though I'm white, and we've been there for 3 generations. And so I'm embedded in knowing the insider life of Hawaii. And so I started writing the first book, Blood Orchids, about, it was stimulated by a real life situation. I'm actually a mental health therapist in private practice and clinical social worker, but I've always, you know, been writing on the side. But that first book was me beginning to write the book I wanted to read. That was about the real Hawaii and the unwritten rules of life there, and the real kinds of people there, and the pidgin dialect that we use there. And then it just kind of mushroomed on and on. So now that's become part of my brand. I have 2 major series that are set in Hawaii, but I'm also doing other things in other genres.
Now, that's interesting. I actually didn't know that Hawaii had a pidgin dialect. I knew of other islands that did, but I haven't actually been to Hawaii, although my wife was born there many years ago.
Really?
Yeah,
she was.
Yeah, she was born on the military base, and my father-in-law has never forgiven my mother-in-law for making him leave the Marine Corps and move back to Georgia.
Oh, man.
Never gotten over it.
That's a tough one.
Now, have you gotten feedback from other Hawaiians about your stories that are set there?
Yeah, that they have passed the authenticity test. And believe me, folks from over there are pretty pretty intense. You know, there's many, many books written about Hawaii, but not that many that have the authentic real flavor. And so, I have a lot of fans in Hawaii that are local folks, and I'm pretty proud of that because they're a tough crowd. But again, that was also part of why I took the indie path, because by the time I got an agent, in about 2008, and we began developing the packaging, and I had three books in the series done by then, and she was a very good agent who had done really big deals in her time. And but the market was just beginning to sort of do its death dance, as some of it, well, many people are in denial that it ever has, but it was happening anyway, kind of like climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like really gung-ho and for sure I can get you and we'll be the next Lisa Gardner in Hawaii kind of thing. And then she just got fed up by 2010, not being able to sell anything but like celebrity cookbooks. And so she retired. And at that point I was looking at, oh my gosh, I have to start this search again for an agent. And I had enough feedback on the books that I was willing to take a chance with them myself and just be like, oh, what the heck, I'm going to go for it myself. And I did make some really key good decisions early on that set me up for success.
Now, a lot of people don't realize that, first of all, the agent search itself can take years. Then the agent searching for a publisher can take years. But even after you've signed, it can take years just to get book number one out. So had you done that with three books written, it could have been a decade before book three came out, even with a good agent and a good contract.
Yes. And she actually did get me a contract. And you're going to laugh when you hear this. It was for ebooks only. It was for $10,000 for the entire, by then I was on book four, for the entire line, you know. And they were only going to publish ebooks, and I was like, you know, the reason I want a publishing deal is to have real books and real stores. And I am not just no. I said no. Well, it turns out within a month of launching my books, my first book, I had made $10,000. So I was really happy that I had gone the indie road.
Yeah, sometimes you look back and it's almost scary to think what would have happened had I gotten a traditional publishing deal, because at that time we didn't know what the potential for indie was. But, you know, you mentioned a $10,000 advance on three books just to illustrate how the market has changed or stayed frozen. I know people who are still getting that for a three-book deal, and sometimes not even for ebook only. So things are really not improving overall in the traditional publishing marketplace, it doesn't seem.
Right. And yet you're still occasionally seeing these headlines for these outrageous things, you know, deals offered to debut authors. And I still just have to kind of scratch my head and go, well, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's a strange crapshoot nowadays. Now, you alluded to doing some things right that you felt helped you get started. What do you think you did well or lucked into when you launched that first series?
First of all, I got into it with a business mindset. And so even though I love writing and that is why I do this, I also wanted to make money and I wanted to build a business. And so I my grandfather was a self-made millionaire back in the day. And of course all his money was, you know, gone in the stock market and whatnot. But he sat me at his knee many, many years ago and had said, you have to spend money to make money, was one of the things I remember him telling me. And when I made the decision to launch, I investigated how I could. Back in 2010, there wasn't the information out now that you there is. There's tons of information now of how to do it right from the get-go. I didn't have any of that. I was feeling around in the dark trying to guess, and I had a little money, and it was that $10,000 that I had gotten from some sort of family investment, and I convinced my husband we were going to spend it on my books. I got a PR company. The PR company was good. They're still around. It's called BookSparks. They're expensive. I only hired them for 3 months, but they gave me really key advice, and they also gave me some professionals that I ended up working with for years afterwards. So they wanted to take charge of my covers, and they gave me a really fabulous but expensive cover artist who did all the late crime covers. And then, an editor and, different kinds of, they put me together with the right people to package the books properly and then give a PR surge as I launched forward back then. And that really got things off the ground. And 2010, if we look historically, was also a key time for a lot of people who are well established as indies, that we all got going right at that time. So I was lucky in that way.
Yeah, I think that was the year I was still working full time, but my indie income quickly surpassed what I was making full time. That would be the year I made my decision to change. It was a big year. So kind of take us through how your career progressed after that.
Well, I was still working full time too. I had I worked for the state of Hawaii as a behavior health specialist in the public schools. So I worked with kids with emotional and behavioral difficulties, helping them with navigating school and basically being a school counselor. And I also worked private practice on the side in mental health. And then I was writing like a fiend on the weekends and after work. And my passion, seeing that readers liked my books, one thing that I'm known for is a lot of interaction with my readers and being very engaged via social media. And it actually is because readers fuel my creative fire. So readers wanting my work and encouraging me and saying, where's the next one? That's what gets me going. And anyway, by 2013, I left my state job, which I never thought I would ever in a million years leave. But I had about seven or eight books out by then, and I was just wanted all my time to go to writing and marketing, as always has to be when you're an indie who's doing well. You're doing both. You're a business person who's writing. And so I was able to leave the state job and then eventually the private practice, and now I am 100% I'm a hybrid too, because I've sold stuff with different, foreign rights and audiobook rights. But my publishing is all self.
Okay. You talked about marketing as being an integral part of what you do. What sorts of marketing do you find yourself doing today?
Oh goodness. I was just on a conference call with my writing partner for our co-authored series. And the thing that we're focusing on a lot right now is creating really, really snazzy sign-up landing pages that are attached to a freebie book that then create a cascade of interactive emails, and we build our email lists. I'm partnering with Emily Kimmelman, who writes another women's action adventure series, the Sydney Rye Mysteries, and we put together and we wrote these apocalyptic romance thrillers. They're called the Scorch series. So if you're interested in love in the time of pandemic, we're the ones for you. But Emily is a little younger than me. So I'm in my 50s, early 50s, and Emily's, in her 30s. And she is so savvy with tech, it just blows my mind. And so our partnership has been great because I've been able to learn a lot from her about the kinds of things that are working really well in marketing nowadays. So we're focusing on building our email list because these are leaders that we belong to us now. They're not because of Amazon or because of BookBub or because of someone else that's a third party that's, you know, these are readers who have chosen to be part of our stable and that we can market to directly. And anyone starting out, if you begin your first book with the idea that you're going to build your email list and you're going to capture and keep your readers, you are off to a good start. And I didn't really tweak to that about until I had 3 or 4 books out. And I, again, missed a lot of opportunity that you can bypass.
I did the same thing. You know, I've been doing indie for a long time. And early on, some other authors were just manually doing their email list, just blind copying and all their readers. And I wish I had started then. Even once MailChimp and things like that came along, I was 6 months or more behind the curve on that. I'm doing fine, but that's one thing I really wish I had done better. Now, in terms of mailing lists, do you feel like you get better results from people who read your book, come directly to your site, or seek you out and come to your site as opposed to things like InstaFreebie, where you're swapping a free book on someone else's site for an email address?
Well, I'm doing both. I don't use InstaFreebie. I use BookFunnel, and I do, partner with other writers to give away books, and basically readers go to a page where all these available freebies are, and they can pick the ones they want, and they basically sign up for your email list, and they become part of this cascade effect of potentially becoming a dedicated reader, which is what we would like to see. And I try to reward readers entering my chute, if you will, by giving them a lot of good freebies and a lot of interaction along the way. If they've made it past a couple, 2, 3 books that they haven't had, I tell them about a special. Often they will buy it. And then pretty soon I'll interact with them on one of my Facebook groups or what have you. So which way works better? I'm not 100% sure. There's these group things that you can sign up for and pay for nowadays. Who is that really popular guy? It's called Book Sweeps. And they'll have a big sweepstakes thing that readers enter, and you're on there with like 50 other books, you know, and then you guys all get the emails at the end. I've participated in those, and you often get a lot of unsubscribes when you put them into your own list, right? Because they didn't find you organically. They thought they were signing up for a sweepstakes, and now what? They're getting an email from you? So I always target those with a freebie right away, introducing myself. Hi, I'm Toby Neal. I'm from Hawaii. Do you like, you know, mysteries set in paradise? Here's my free book. Check it out. If you don't like it, you won't hear from me again. If you do like it, here's another free book, you know. And so that has, I can usually integrate at least 70% of emails that I harvest from there by being very generous and interactive, and a warm tone, I think, also helps.
Okay. Yeah, I like that idea. That sounds great. Now, you mentioned co-authoring. Why don't we talk about that a little bit? Because co-authoring is something I do a ton of. So tell us a little bit about your project and how you went about it.
Well, Emily has a Kindle World. And David, I understand you have a Kindle World as well?
Yep. And you do also, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah. So Emily and I had Kindle Worlds, and we wrote for each other's Kindle World and got to be friends that way. And she was the originally was the one who joined my Kindle World and then actually flew to Maui to meet me, which was a big investment. And of course, she's like, but it's Maui and I'm going on vacation anyway. And why not write a book while I'm there? And she just had so much fun energy. We hit it off great and powered out a couple of novellas in like a weekend together. And so I actually have been writing like a fiend since I jumped off this cliff and producing between 4 and 8 books a year ever since. I began publishing in 2010, and I kind of hit a wall in, because you do burn out. There's many ways to outfox the burnout, but I did kind of burn out, and for about 4 months at the backside of 2016, I just couldn't get inspired. I was just dry. And I thought, you know, I was hearing on Joanna Pym's podcast about co-authoring, and it was just blogging everywhere about it. And I thought,
We don't talk about Jo on this on this show. She's a pain in the butt.
Oh, okay.
No.
Sorry.
I'm kidding. She's my buddy.
Okay. I'm like, oh, she's so nice. But anyway, so anyway, that's how I thought of it. And I thought, who is a person who is filled with energy and just gets me going? That was Emily. And so I approached her. What do you think about trying co-authoring? And she loved the idea. She had just had a baby and hadn't been writing either for about 4 months and didn't really know how to get back in the saddle. So we decided to do something completely different than either of our regular work. And we hit upon, we had really a lot of concerns about the world and what's happening in the world. This was in January of 2016. So it was a while back before the election and all the other things that have happened since. But we brainstormed, an apocalypse. We both love reading apocalyptic stuff, and we wanted to do romance. And so we came up with this entire pandemic and a government plot and, a place that all the people were going to. And then each book is a story of each of this awesome Italian family who have basically a armed compound out in Idaho. And each of them is trying to make their way across the country in the middle of a pandemic and the woman they fall in love with on the way. And so, of course, there's bullets flying and, you know, every kind of natural disaster and, you know, all the things you expect in an apocalyptic book. But also we've got some wonderful romance that I'm very proud of in there. So we planned them all before we started writing one, and then we wrote almost all of them. Only the last two did we write on the fly before we started releasing them, and then we released them one per month this year.
Is this series over, or is it something open-ended that you could continue if you wanted to?
Yes, it is. It's over in the sense of these first six books that we planned and plotted. But it's an open world in the sense that we have several side roads that we can develop. One is what happens in a pandemic in Hawaii, which Emily's like, I want to come back to Hawaii and do research. So I'm fascinated with that topic. Having lived there my whole life and knowing how dependent we are on outside resources, there is a lot of concern of what would happen in a major disaster out in the middle of the ocean.
Lord of the Flies on a giant scale.
Yes, yes. I worry of that, yes.
Now, when you're co-authoring, I have a few different ways I do it depending on which co-author I'm writing with. What was your process of actual planning and writing when working with another author?
Well, I would love to hear your process first.
Okay.
Because you've done so much of it and you have so many partners. I was truly impressed when I saw your lineup.
Well, like I said, it's just because I'm incredibly lazy. So I just sit around and James Patterson it all. For the most part, I create the initial story in conversation with the other author, but it's pretty much me being heavy-handed. I create the story beats. And the outline is very thorough. Sometimes the outline is 15 to 20,000 words. And then I pass it over to the co-author who writes the first draft. Second draft comes back to me for fine tuning. And then it goes to my editor. And I then do the third draft. Well, betas and then editor. And I do the other drafts. That is the process with almost everyone. In some cases, it's because they're working in my established worlds. And I just know the story structure better. Also because I found myself in a situation with a couple of co-authors who just didn't know how to properly pace an action-adventure story, mm-hmm. that the rewriting and mm-hmm. fixing the story was more work than if I had just written it myself. And
yep.
that's sometimes a problem. And then with one particular yep. co-author, he's fantastic with prose and just doesn't have a lot of background in the genre. With another co-author, mm-hmm. and it's just this one guy, he and I have known each other forever. We were in the same action-adventure writers Yahoo group back in the early 2000s. We read the same stuff, so we kick it around and agree on the premise, and then he just goes ahead and writes the first draft. But he's the only person with whom I work that way. Everybody else, I basically create what I call draft 0.5 and then pass it on to them to bang out the first draft.
Wow, that's so different from our process. And again, we didn't spend a ton of time researching different ways that you could co-author. We just sort of plunged in. And I loved her writing, and I only saw her finished writing, so I knew she got there. But I didn't know that her process was extremely different than mine. And so we experienced some real gnarly growing pains, I have to say. And that's why I would never say it was easier to co-author.
No, it's like marriage and getting to know one another and live together.
Exactly. And so the first thing we discovered was that I was a plotter and she was a pantser. And she had always done her books, sort of stream of consciousness, their first person present tense action adventures things with, she'll have an idea and then she just gallops along with it. And she does most of it by dictation, where I was like a police procedural. You have to have, there's things that always have to happen in every book. There's, the morgue scene, and then there's, the CSI aspects, and there's.
And if you don't have it all worked out, you're going to screw up. Yeah.
Oh yeah. So I started, so I kind of laid it down like we have to outline these books. And then I was more control-y and it was my idea. So I started the outlines. But what we quickly found, and then what we did was we divided them by character. So I wrote the men and she wrote the women. And then we would alternate chapters. So what was interesting was that things were evolving, and changing, not according to the outline. And on the first book, we allowed that to happen, and we both got completely giddy, and we pounded out that book, departed from the outline after day two, and pounded it out in like 13 days.
Wow.
And we were just dizzy at the end, and then it was just terrible. It was so bad, Dave. It was the worst thing either of us had written in years, and we were appalled, So we had to go back, and I literally cut 20,000 words. I hadn't had to do an edit this gnarly in years, and I was so discouraged. It made me almost throw in the towel. But we had made too much of an investment. We had decided we were going to do 6 books. So we just had to figure it out. And what we ended up with was still something of, I think for us, that structure that you described wouldn't work. We're both too strong-willed. We both want to have too much of our hands in the pot, And we liked the dynamic of our characters. Well, it was pretty sexy in a way, if you can, imagine that. One character would do something, and then the other character would do something, and then the interaction that they had with each other. It was just so much fun that it hooked us in to solve all the problems that we had with our plot. After the first book and the gnarly rewrite, we then settled on working out the outline together. And then we would leave like the last third open for the characters to
now that's
come
an
up
interesting
with.
Process.
We had
okay.
an idea how, yeah. So we had the end. We knew that they would reach the haven and they would resolve their crap with their mama. So there's a strong Italian mama in there. And all the kids had something, going on with her that they had to get resolved. So there's like a lot of different layers to our stories. And they knew they'd have a happy ending and they'd get there. But how exactly they would resolve their primary wound. So we would plot these characters with a wound that had to be resolved. And So there's a lot of character development that went into that, and that was, for us, the fun was in that, some of that improvisational stuff.
Yeah, you talk about it being a process and finding out what works with your co-author and with one of the guys with whom I write a lot of books. We had to go through a process, too. Our first novella, we did the alternating chapters thing. We agreed on a rough outline, and the feedback we got was that, you know, it's not a bad book, but I know who wrote which chapter, and it's very uneven, even though we had gone over one another's work. So our second book, we agreed on the outline, and he lives in Australia, so our days are almost completely opposite. So I would write a chapter. He would wake up and revise the chapter and write the next one, and we tag-teamed it back and forth, and then we each made a pass over it. Well, then we sent it off to our mutual friend Stephen Saville, who's been in the game forever, for feedback, and he said, look, guys, I like Dave's stuff. I like Al's stuff. This has no voice. You've written one another's voice utterly out of this book. It's bland. Plot's fine. Story's bland. So we had to go back, and we agreed that I felt like he had the snappier prose, and he completely rewrote it. And so that's how we got to this draft 0.5 thing where I'm doing the bare bones, and then he's writing the first draft. And then because he's British and Australian, he gets final say on those characters, and I do on the American ones, at least in terms of dialogue and stuff. But yeah, we had to go through three books
before we found what worked. That is fascinating.
Yeah, because one of our series has two British protagonists, another has an Australian protagonist. So we're sometimes bouncing around with the dialogue and stuff. But it's still fun. It's a different exercise. And he's urban fantasy and horror, but I learn from what he does. He has some phrasings and things that I hate, but he's excellent in short fiction. And so I found that in my own writing, I'm beginning to pick up on a few of the things that he normally does. And I'd like to think that my plotting and stuff is rubbing off on him as well. So we're both growing from the experience, and that's a good thing.
We absolutely. And so I wouldn't trade it. I mean, there were many moments where I thought, what am I doing? You know, we're working so hard, and then we have to split the money too.
Yeah, that's a bummer.
but it was also like I think our craft, both of us improved, and both of us improved in the marriage of our marketing too, because we brought different strengths. I'm very hands-on with my readers and very interactive with them in Facebook groups and stuff. Emily is a young mom and doesn't have that kind of time, but she's tech savvy, and so she's given me that. And so kind of between the two of us, we have like the perfect marketing team, because we have both the personal touch of nurturing readers, and we have the super slick back matter in all of our books that, you know, is a nice marketing tool.
Yeah, I feel like I lean more toward your strengths as well, with a background in ministry and teaching. I feel like I interact with people really well, and I have my little minions group that is a Facebook group of my most dedicated people. And then, of course, my author page, and I love dealing with people. You know, there are moments when difficult people come along and make you sad, but for the most part, it's really awesome, and I don't mind being hands-on that
it
way.
Is.
But it is great when you meet somebody who's very good at something that you don't have any skills in, or you don't have as much skill in. And I think that's part of being a successful indie, is recognizing where you're strong and where you're weak, and finding a way to fill those gaps, since a publisher isn't doing it all for you. Now, you talk about collaboration. How about with your Kindle world? Do you have any hands-on with that, or at this point, is it just people are writing cool stories in your universe?
You know, I am actually, I think, one of the most interactive Kindle World authors, besides like Stephen Conkley, who does a lot with his authors too. Actually, Stephen was the one who I went to when I first got my Kindle World, because I had a vision that if I got really involved with my authors, that I could influence the quality of the material. And that then when I put my, you know, weight behind pushing the Kindle World stuff, my readers would trust me enough to try it. And that would be to all of our benefit. So I went to Stephen, who I heard had just a lot of interaction with his world and his authors. And he told me all the things he did, and I just followed it to the letter. I made a Facebook group, and I figured out, you know, I promoted them through interviews on my blog, and now we do planned launches 2-3 times a year. And I basically, I've stopped reading the Kindle World books because it's just gotten to be too much and I truly, truly don't have time. But I love the Kindle World. It's a blast. And I'm actually doing, I think I might be one of the only, maybe there's another one doing this, but I'm actually having a retreat with my Kindle World authors right here in my town. I live on the Russian River in California right now. And I've basically reserved a small inn nearby and negotiated a really nice rate. And I'm having my Kindle World authors come out and meet for a 3-day writing retreat. And we're going to hang out. So
that is a very cool way of doing it. Yeah. Because what I did I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it's just all about the relationships. And I enjoy that.
Yeah, what I did was since I had a stable of co-authors established, I had each of them write something and we co-authored it. Mm-hmm. And then some other writing friends, I co-authored with them and literally had my hands on every freaking book. And it was great in a way because, you know, we went ahead and put my name on the cover as a co-author and it got the world off to a good start, but it really, really impacted my productivity the second half of last year as I was getting the world ready to go. And, I just saw that someone had put out a Dane Matic Kindle World that I didn't even know about. I wish he had at least touched base with me just so I could be supportive of him, but I did send out a newsletter blast once I learned. But yeah, I think my next step is going to be doing more like you where I'm not hands-on with the actual writing, but still finding ways to be supportive and help these guys along. Of course, my regular co-authors, they did the one Kindle World and they're like, we're done because we want the foreign royalties and the paperback royalties and the audio royalties and all that stuff. So I doubt I'll be able to get many more Kindle Worlds out of them, but you might get some. But it can be a really fun thing. It's just nice to see that much enthusiasm for a world that you created. It's really, really cool.
Oh, it's incredible. It's incredible. And the things that people come up with, like for instance, one of my heroine has a Rottweiler dog that is her, you know, it's a police dog that flunked out of the academy and that she has, you know, as her pet. And of course it's a very heroic dog and does all. Well, I have like 4 books in the Kindle World that are from the dog's perspective about the dog as a puppy, you know, on and on. I'm just like, and I love it. It's just like things I would never have time to develop, even if I had the idea, which I wouldn't, you know? So to me, having a Kindle World is just, it's a huge compliment that just never stops being, for me, emotionally rewarding. And that's why I am so motivated to give back to the authors because it makes my series live on and my characters that I care about, they live on too. Even though I've completed the series at 12 books, I miss them. But with the Kindle World there, there's always more books. So it's just such a joy, I have to say. And I know there's authors who think it's a pain or do absolutely nothing with their world, but I love it, and I consider it a huge compliment.
Now, let's suppose an author is listening who would like to write a Kindle World as a way of beginning to get their name out there. What advice would you give to an author?
Well, I would certainly say research the Kindle Worlds and find one where you are going to have support from that main author, at least mentions on their website, an email blast when your book comes out, you know, all the way to there's all kinds of variations of more. But if you want to be sure that you're going to tap into that, the readers of that person's world, try and get a supportive author. And then another thing would be really tune up your back matter, because your back matter is where you're going to try to be able to draw that, you know, the fans of that world into your own work. I tend to have 2 different kinds of writers in my world, either seasoned pros who want to get more eyes on their backlist, or brand new writers who are, you know, maybe they're a fan or maybe they're just getting started. And either way, there's so many pluses to writing a Kindle World novella. I've actually done 2. I did one for Emily Kimmelman's Kindle World and I did one for Russell Blake's Kindle World. And both were because those authors asked me to. I don't think I would go and just, you know, randomly write something and upload it to a portal. I definitely wouldn't do that. I'd be looking for partnerships that are beneficial to my writing and my business.
Absolutely.
And
now you've talked about
is a great way to bring in readers.
Yeah. Now you've talked about, you've got your police procedural, you've got your apocalyptic romance stuff. Talk about your Wired series.
Oh, super exciting. That one is just taking off right now. I had a tremendously successful BookBub giveaway. Over 100,000 have gone out so far. And now the series is just going gangbusters. So if you're a new indie and you're wondering how to sell books, the formula of 5 or 6 books in a series and the first book free with a BookBub is still working. Just FYI, that is still working to get a whole kind of freight train effect with your books. And even though the market has taken a lot of hits this year in my experience, and this series, it's called Paradise Crime. I also, I have a terrific heroine. I actually had Russell Blake read my first book, Wired In, that's currently free. And I was able to get a blurb from him, and because it is in that action-adventure genre, very much like the Jet series. She's one of those kick-ass women who can do it all but has a soft, broken heart underneath. And so I have a really exciting, fun, and dynamic series. She starts out in the FBI in the first book, and then she becomes a private contractor. And basically, my tagline is, she's like girl with a dragon tattoo who's becoming a female Jack Reacher. So mm-hmm. She's leaving all established law enforcement and going on her own in by book 4 and 5. And boy, I just couldn't be having more fun. And it's a blast.
So you've got the thrillers down, it sounds like. And off the air, you and I were chatting about moving into other genres. What are you thinking about for your next move?
Well, I've been trying to get my romance line going, and a lot of that is, and that's really tricky. I'm actually finding the romance, even though I know my romance writing is good. Like I have a 3-book series of new adult romances, sort of coming of age, first love discovery books. And I know they're well written. I've got awards.
Oh, I didn't realize they were already out. Okay.
But, yeah, I have 3 of them. And I just cannot get that line off the ground to save my life. And I asked some of the folks in our group, what's the secret? What's the magic sauce? And they were kind of like, well, you either hit the right nerve or you don't. And I'm like, isn't it just about putting abs on the cover? Because I'm just not comfortable with putting abs on the cover. And we had a whole debate about abs or no abs. But apparently, you don't have to have abs for a romance book to succeed, although there's debate about that. So I'm backing away from it right now because my thrillers are doing so well. I don't want to keep throwing energy and time at something that isn't taking off. So I do find that crossing genre lines in a really radical big way, like new adult sweet romance versus action thrillers, the same readers, the Venn diagram of that is very small, of people who are going to enjoy that crossover. So it's basically that's why people do pen names, I guess.
That's been my experience as well. Now, did you publish as Toby Neal for that too?
Well, when I first put those books out, I did them under a pen name and they did so poorly that I was really horrified. And I realized what people are up against, because I did. I had good branding, the writing is good, et cetera. I had 0 platform for romance, though. And that made me realize this is what a new author is facing, was unknown. It is a tough, tough market, and it is saturated with material and giveaways and freebies and even freebies with awards on them. And so so I went back to my own name because at least I figured, well, there's the Venn diagram. There's a small intersecting circle of people who will like this. And there's a romantic thread in all of my books, so people who like more than a thread will pick these up, and they did. But it still wasn't enough to justify the amount of time, energy, and money that I put in. I've rebranded those suckers 3 different times with new covers. I made a whole website. I solicited readers, made a new email list. And basically, I'm like, you know what? I think I'm just going to stick with what's working right now.
Yeah, that's where that's the point I reached with my fantasy. I did fantasy just as a palate cleanser, had a different pen name, but didn't really put any effort into it. Finally, when I completed a trilogy, I rebranded, and it did pretty well. I did the obvious good strategies, had a co-authored mm-hmm. one shortly thereafter in the same universe. It did pretty well, but not as well. And then this past year, I launched a new universe with some other writers. It was really cool. It was sort of Pirates of the Caribbean meets Tim Powers on Stranger Tides. I was so excited about it.
Oh, my God. That sounds fabulous.
And, epic failure. It's the worst performing thing I've launched in a long time. And I tried to use my David Wood resources as well. But the problem is all my also bots were immediately filled with David Wood, Russell Blake, things like that. And it just didn't work. So I don't know if I completely rebranded David DeBoard and wrote like crazy, put out lots of stuff, maybe I could get in there and make it work. But at this point, it's, like you said, just not really worthwhile to me to do it when I could be doing David Wood stuff and doing well. So that was a bit of a bummer. But I don't want to republish fantasy under David Wood because of that whole genre and subgenre confusion.
Can you say a little bit about that for the listeners, about the Ocelbots and that whole thing? Because that is something I'm just learning about. I read Chris Fox's book on that topic, on training, basically training the algorithms of Amazon to recognize and to try to market for you.
Sure.
It's super confusing. What do you say something more about that?
Yeah, basically when you put out a book and people begin buying it, the first thing that Amazon's system will do is take a look at the purchase history of those first buyers and look at the things they've purchased recently and things they purchased the most. And those become displayed on your product page as also bought. Customers who bought this book also bought. So when people went to my pirate fantasy and looked down and saw that it was filled with action, adventure, and thriller, that might have created some confusion. The second factor is that whatever those also bots are, that determines, and this is probably more important, whose book pages your book now appears on. So let's say I put out this pirate fantasy and all my action adventure readers buy it. My pirate fantasy is now appearing on Russell Blake's page and Jeremy Robinson's page and James Rollins' page and things like that. So it's appearing in front of the wrong set of readers. That also affects the recommendations, the likelihood that it's going to be emailed out in a, hey, you might be interested in. So all these James Rollins fans and Clive Cussler fans are getting an email from Amazon with James Rollins, Clive Cussler, and a David DeBoard pirate fantasy. So I was reaching the wrong readers by launching strictly with my David Wood list, and even just by letting it be known to my advanced readers that this was my book. Because, of course, all of them jumped on it right away because they like my stuff, which is wonderful. But again, that their purchase history was detrimental. So it seems like the way to do it is, or at least what I'm going to try with my super secret pen name that I'm going to launch soon, is it's going to be a secret. And I'm going to try to use AMS ads and just target the hell out of the popular indie and trad pub authors that are the most like my books that I'm putting out, the titles that are most like it. The same with Facebook ads. Be very careful who you target and be very precise. That's my hope anyway. And maybe even the book bump sponsored ads. Just have really, really tight focusing, even if you're not hitting as broad a target, in hopes that those first purchases are going to be from exactly the right kind of authors, and that's then where your book is going to appear in the recommendation engine. So that's the idea.
But that would only work if you do a pen name.
Right. Because as soon as, you know, otherwise it's going to get, you know, they're going to do, their Amazon's going to send out their notification email to all your followers, which impacts it.
Mm-hmm.
If you have BookBub followers mm-hmm. and you add it to their system, same deal. So yeah, you really have to start fresh. If the genre is too far from where you're working, my action adventure and my thrillers, they do okay. And then my monster thriller has done really well because there's enough action adventure in it. My horror book didn't do so well. My young adult paranormal mm-hmm. did shit. So, and of course, fantasy mm-hmm. is doing poorly. So, you know, I've mm-hmm. found that the farther you get from where you built that core audience, the more difficult it is to leverage that into success.
Yes. Boy, and how I wish that, actually, you and I both are friends of Russell Blake, and he has been, you know, really terrific in giving some wonderful blog posts about writing and marketing and different things. And he said one where, you know, he writes different genres too. But it's, we have to, that's the thing though. It's like, we should just keep doing what's working, but we're creative people and we get interested in other things. You know, and I just can't seem to help that, you know, like, oh, I would love to do a mystery set in wine country. And I'm like, well, how does that fit in? You know, I need to stay focused on what my brand is and what my readers are expecting in order to keep moving books. And then there's just your passion project. You know, if you're successful enough, you can make room for a passion project here and there. The trouble is that it's hard to see your passion project sort of languish because it's not finding a readership when you're used to a level of success.
Yeah, it's really frustrating. I did one 1930s era pulp adventure that was a blast to write. Got what I felt like was amazing cover art, just perfect for it. I sold a bunch by hand at the Doc Savage convention, but it really didn't do much in broad sales. So I really want to do mm-hmm. book two. So at this point, that's my warm-up. Every day I set the timer for 15 minutes and I crank out 300 to 500 words on that and then set it aside because I just can't justify that being my full-time writing project at any given time.
Mm-hmm.
And if my
mm-hmm.
wife ever finds out how much less I sell of anything other than Dane Maddock, I'll be writing nothing but Dane Maddock forever. She'll be standing over me with a whip.
Right, right. And that's why my husband is like, why did you finish writing the lay books? And I'm like, because the arc was complete. He's like, the arc is never complete.
Build a new
the
arc.
Get back there. Get back there to your typewriter. Write more of those. I'm like, no, I'm going to make this other series go. And I think I am finally making this second series go. And she's a side character from Lay Crime and close enough and related enough that I'm drawing my readers along in this new direction towards a Jack Reacher crime solving. It is tricky. It's tricky.
Yeah. And
to be a creative person and make a living at something creative.
Yeah. It's interesting. One of the things that we've done with the co-authors is my main series is very much modern day Indiana Jones. So we spun off two series with characters I created. One is his ex-girlfriend, and she's basically Lara Croft, Tomb Raider. And even though it's very much the same kind of story, a lot of people say they don't like it because they love the male sidekick in the main series who can be kind of an ass, but they find the female lead to be kind of a bitch. And it's
mm-hmm.
and it's just, it's got to be gender. And then my other series is a James
yeah.
Rollins-style team, and the leader is an African-American female. And some people, she's just a weak leader. But you read the book and it's like, how is she a weak leader? This woman kicks ass and takes no shit. She's totally modeled after a really good friend of mine. But again, you're up against perception whenever you move away from either your main characters or move into a different gender or race or anything. It's really odd how people perceive stuff that's created by the same author in a very similar genre even.
Well, we do it too. You know, I was always a Patricia Cornwell fan before I began writing, you know, in mysteries in that similar ilk. And I loved her Kay Scarpetta stories and just could never take to her Lucy stories, you know, where she would try to put these other lines in and stuff. And even when they were in the same ballpark, I just like, no, I'm attached to these characters. And
yeah, I can
when
see
I put that, that's a, That's a great question for your reader group. You know, and I put that out to my reader group and I asked them just open-ended. So what, you know, when you have a favorite author, will you read their side stuff of this or that or the other thing? And most of them will openly say, no, you know, I love you, but I don't like your this or that, you know, give me more of that. And it all goes back to all the reasons that we read. You know, first, any writer worth their salt is also a reader. And I know that I go to certain authors because I'm craving a certain kind of emotional experience for whatever reason. You know, the mood of the day or an escape from life or the warm, fuzzy feeling. I tend to like to read romance for when I need a warm, fuzzy feeling about the world. I wanted to read action adventure or mystery when I want to be sort of taken away out of my own head. So I go to those readers for a certain emotional experience. And when you understand the psychology of that, then you can predict reader patterns more accurately.
You know, it's interesting. One of the things that this has reminded me of is that one of the reasons I started spinning off and venturing into different subgenres and series is concern over saturating readers with my main series. But as I've watched indie authors succeed, I'm not convinced there is a saturation point. Do you have any thoughts on that?
You know, that's interesting. I have never thought of it that way. I think of my series as trains, and each book is another car in the train, and the leading book is the power engine that's pushing, you know, the train. Mm-hmm. And I see them as perpetual motion machines that are going. Whenever I putting in energy would be getting a book bub or doing a new ad campaign or trying out some new thing that gives exposure. Like I just recently was, and I was never on Google Play. I didn't really know what the
platform was. I procrastinated on that one too.
I didn't know how to get on it. I was just like, forget it. They're lame anyway, or they seem like they were, whatever. I never got on. Well, just in the last week, I was approached by a Google rep, and they offered me a contract. And lo and behold, all my books are about to start off on Google Play on a month when I've got a book bub on my first in series. And man, I am psyched. I'm like, this is a whole world of new readers who have never read any Toby Neal books, potentially. And they're going to get it at an ideal time for me to get exposure, and all the books will be, that freight train is ready to pull out of the station in a new direction. So that's how I think of it, is these trains that are just like, they're perpetual motion. You just got to put energy into them periodically, and then they pick up speed again, and new readers and new writers, you know? So I'm trying to circle the globe with a series of different train tracks. And different kinds of books. But what I am realizing is that I cannot do all these different genres and be successful with them. And that's disappointing, and that's a hard lesson. But I'm learning my lesson, and I'm figuring out ways around it. Like if I do want to write romance, I think I might go back to the pen name thing and try your strategy, because that sounds like an interesting way to go.
Well, I don't know if it's going to succeed. I haven't tried it yet, but we're hoping. I'll keep you posted, though.
Keep us posted.
All right, time to put you on the spot. Let's say you are one of those indie authors who is just starting out. What would you advise those people to do? What are some of your top recommendations for getting started if you were beginning today with nothing?
Well, first of all, I do some coaching, very small, because I'm a mental health therapist in private practice. I'm eminently qualified to tackle both the mental health and the marketing and, you know, expertise aspects. So I do some author coaching. I have two clients right now that I'm helping get off the tracks at this very, you know, time. And we work via email and phone. So this is a good question for me, and I can answer it pretty clearly. I would say that you have to focus on the quality of your product first. If you're going to be successful, you have to think of it from the beginning as a business and have a business mindset, and the principles of business are how you're going to run your books. So I consider a book a product, and my product has got to be top quality. And you can't, the fanciest, prettiest marketing campaign in the world is not going to work if your book is crap. So work on craft and create several books, and then get consistent branding, recognizable with your cover. Pick something. This is out of Russell Blake's many good words of advice, but you know, in my words, it's the same thing. Pick a genre that's big enough to keep your interest for a good long time, because of the reasons you and I were just talking about, Dave. You know, we lose interest in something, we want to try something else. Well, you've already kind of painted yourself into a corner. So with your current, you know, social media presence and so on. So pick a nice big genre umbrella. And then again, pick something that you care about a lot, because passion will drive your writing. You know, if you care about the topics covered, like I care a lot about social issues and environmental issues of Hawaii, and that's why those are an ongoing theme in all of my work, because I can write about that till the cows come home. I care about my home state and its unique challenges in the world. And so when you have that, the passion comes across in the writing. And then, like I said, get at least three books before you even start really trying to market them, and get consistent branding, and get out on all the social media platforms, and just launch with as much of a bang as you can raise money for. Partner with good people, and begin as you mean to go on. Top quality all the way.
Fantastic. Well, I have kept you talking for about an hour, so we're going to wrap it up. You've given me all of your links, including a lot of your free books. If people want to check them out, I'm going to post that all on woodonwords.com. But just as we wrap up, tell everybody where they can find you online.
Yeah, I have a website at tobyneal.net. And, of course, I'm on all the platforms. Just look up Toby Neal, and it should pop up pretty quick. Thanks so much, Dave. It was really enjoyable talking with you. And I actually learned a lot from you today.
Thank you. Appreciate having you. All right, that is it for our interview. Hope you got something out of it. I know I certainly did. And I hope you will check out Toby's work. If you go to woodonwords.com and check out the post that accompanies this podcast episode, you'll find links to several of her free books and where you can find her online. So as always, thank you for listening, and we will see you next time.